We have with us right now, joining us on PMP Radio Network, we have Marlon Hargis. Marlon is the keyboardist for the band Exile, and you know them. I'm going to kiss you all over and over again. Now, of course, it sounds a lot better than that. But Marlon, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mark. I wasn't going to make any comments about your singing. But,
yeah, don't do that at the beginning of the interview.
You got the lyrics right, at least.
Yeah,
so that's good.
People always say to me, Mark, what'd you do with the money? And I always tell them I spent the money my mother gave me on singing lessons on other things. So,
no comment.
That's why I'm on radio, right? Marlon, you
got
go
a
on
great
radio.
Great radio voice, so stick to that.
I guess if I can do one for the other, one for two, that's all right.
That's good.
So we have Marlon with us, and I love the music of Exile, and I understand we have something in common because you actually used to be a fan of the Exiles. That was what they used to be called when they were on the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars around 1966 or so.
That's true. The band actually started in 63. Me, along with some of the other later members, we were all in bands, you know, in the same, you know, neighboring city, so we all kind of knew each other. But the first time I ever saw the band actually was on a Caravan of Stars show in Lexington, Kentucky. I remember the Young Rascals were on the show, and a group called the Knickerbockers. I remember a great band. And,
they did they did the song called Lies.
Lies. They said a lot, and there was a great show called Where the Action Is.
Yes.
The Daily Show, and they were kind of the house band, and they were a great. I don't know if you'd call them a copy band. They could copy almost any other band.
Yeah, they were great. They could do. You're right. They could actually like mimic the Beatles as well as the Beatles.
Oh yeah, fairly just like the Beatles, and they had a great song Lies, and they were a great live band. But that's the first time I ever saw the band was called the Exiles then, and I had no idea that just a few years later I would join the band in the early 70s. And,
well, why didn't you want to join the Knickerbockers or the Rascals?
Well, I if they'd ask, I would. that's like a lot of people at that time period in the mid-60s. I mean, those bands kind of the world kind of changed at that point, you know, when the Beatles and a lot of these groups like the Rascals came out. You know, I think at a certain point in my life, I figured out, man, this is what I want to do. I had been forced to take piano lessons from when I was 5 years old, and frankly, I hated it. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to be out playing baseball and stuff. But at that point, I realized, man, this is cool. I want to play in a band. That's what I want to do. And it was kind of a turning point in my life in those years.
So you set your sight on the Exiles. And by the way, in the early 70s, they had two keyboard players, not even one. So
that's true.
Yeah, one of them left the band, and all of a sudden, JP, the leader of the band, calls you up.
Yeah, I mean, you know your history of the band. That's pretty darn good.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, JP, I had gotten to be friends with JP and actually a couple of the other players, and one of the keyboard players had left for... So I didn't actually replace him. He had just left for a few months. And for a while, they just had one keyboard player. His name was Buzz Cornelison. And they actually asked me to join as a second keyboard player. I was with another band, and I was also kind of running a recording studio in Lexington. And the guys would come in to record there. So we got to know each other. And then, frankly, it was a no-brainer when they asked me to join because Exile was the band in that part of the country. I mean, everybody wanted to be part of that band, so I was, you know, it took me about 5 seconds to say, well, of course I'll join. So that was it.
But, of course, you were making about $400 or so in a club band, and now they're offering you $75 a week to be an Exile. So you actually took a cut in pay, right?
And, you know, when you're young, you can take that kind of chance.
True.
But you know, the odd thing is, I didn't really question that move. And I think I just had a gut feeling that it was the right move to make. And, you know, like a lot of bands, of course, we'll get to the point where we had a huge, you know, huge success starting in 78. But like a lot of bands, we starred for a lot of years.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, back then, believe it or not, you could, well, it'd be about $300 a month. You could survive on that. But that's about it. But no, it never was a question for me. It wasn't a matter of money. I just love the band.
You know what's interesting, though, folks that are out there, you don't know this, but I do, that Marlon was really, really, really important to the success of Exile. And no, it wasn't because of the keyboards necessarily. It was because of his recording studio and the ability to put songs down. And one of them, I guess, attracted the attention of Michael Chapman, who later wrote Kiss You All Over.
That's right. I've often said, they like my playing. I mean, you know, they wanted me to be an integral part of that. But another factor was the fact that, as you said, I ran a recording studio, and through me, we, you know, got to record, basically demos of songs. And after a couple more years, I guess, through an odd set of circumstances, there was a British producer, as you said, named Mike Chapman. He was very famous in England. He was he produced a group called The Sweet, another group called Smokey. Very successful producer. Well, he had moved to the United States. He moved to Los Angeles, and he was looking for an American band to produce. And then through various hands and those odd circumstances, he heard a demo tape that we had sent out, I think maybe two or three songs that basically I had produced at the studio there in Lexington, and then flew in to see us. We were actually playing at a little party at a apartment complex, if I remember, and he flew in to see us, loved the band, and then, as they say, the rest is history. Even though it wasn't an overnight success even then, we did a lot of recording with Mike before Kiss You All Over happened.
But let me ask you, first of all, it always amazes me when bands spend years and years to become successful, and then after success comes, sometimes they end up breaking up for various reasons.
Right.
But let me ask you, what was it like, though, when all of a sudden Kiss You All Over is huge all over the world, number one hit all over the place? How did that change your life and the band's life?
Well, of course, the obvious answer is money.
Yeah, well, yeah.
but really, that's not, as I say, at the time, that's not the big deal. At the time, it was a situation where literally 1 week we were playing in a club in Lexington, Kentucky for the door, you know, playing for the money that came in the door. And the next Friday we were in Los Angeles filming the Midnight Special and heading out on tour with Aerosmith. So the thing is, it's one of those stories where the things happen so quick, particularly at that age, you almost don't have time to really appreciate and you know, take in the excitement of what's going on. You're just in a kind of I wouldn't say a daze in a sense, maybe for months, because you're just out on tour all of a sudden, literally playing in front of 20,000 people a night. I don't know that it changed our perspectives a lot. Our purpose of being on stage was to entertain, but it changed everything else, and it's kind of hard to imagine or to explain to someone back then how quick a change could happen to a band.
And of course, you know, because of the success of that song, you guys ended up going to South Africa in 1980 and had no idea that you guys were like the Beatles of South Africa.
That's funny. We were booked there, and we had hits in other countries, and obviously, you know, we're stuck in Kentucky. We don't really know what's going on in other countries, you know. So we fly, I think it's like 20-hour flight, you know, to South Africa. We land in Johannesburg, back in those days, the planes landed on the tarmac, and you walked, you know, to the building, and mm-hmm. we got off the plane, and we're all tired and quite frankly hungover, and you know, been on the plane mm-hmm. for 20 hours, and there's like 3,000 or 4,000 people standing on, you know, on the around the building of the airport, standing on the roof and stuff, and we're literally looking around, you know, saying, what are these people here for? What's going on? You know. And then we all of a sudden were shocked to realize they were there to see us. we were huge stars there and didn't even know it. So it was one of those weird shocks.
Now, what was it like though to kind of, even if it was in the moment in South Africa, to kind of live that kind of life? Could you ever empathize with groups like the Beatles who have no lives because they were so recognizable?
Well, you know, I guess there that's the case. I guess really for a few years back then, we were pretty recognizable. I mean, not to the extent of, you know, groups like the Beatles, but it does change your perspective a little in that you know, when you're out on tour, you sort of have to, I guess, be on your toes, you know, about, you know, how you act and so forth. We always joke, thank God there weren't cell phones and the internet back then, mm-hmm. you know, or we'd probably be in a lot of trouble. But another interesting thing is back when you're touring like that, your perspective of most cities is a hotel room and an arena. You don't really get a lot of time to, you know, really look at the scenery or have a chance to check out the places you're working. And that's one thing we actually try to do now if we're traveling in a part of the country that, say, near the Grand Canyon or Mount Rushmore or something, we try to make it a point to maybe have an extra day just to relax and, you know, and kind of enjoy seeing the country, which before we never really saw the country. We just saw hotel rooms and arenas.
Right, yeah. It all looks, as Paul Simon once wrote, each town looks the same to me, the movies and the factories, yeah.
Yeah, but that's unfortunately that's kind of true.
Mm. Yeah, so I thought it was interesting that, you know, in 1978, "Kiss You While Over" was a huge hit, and you had a couple of other pop hits after it. But around the mid '80s, you guys became a country group, and through the '90s, had a ton of number one country songs. How did you get from one to the other?
Well, the interesting thing. The interesting thing to me is that we didn't really change our sound very much. It was just more, I think, a matter of marketing. We always had a sort of an R&B sound, I think, as a pop band, and really pretty much the same through the country field. Our manager, actually a great manager named Jim Morey from Los Angeles, suggested we switch to a country format because songs we had written, or band members had written, were hits for country acts, particularly Alabama. Two of their biggest hits, "Take Me Down," "The Closer You Get," were songs we had written and recorded first. Hmm. But we had released them in the pop field, and frankly, they didn't do anything. You know, I think part of it was at that point. I think the record company kind of lost interest in us.
Mm-hmm.
But And I think it made the transition to the country feel relatively easy for us because we had a certain amount of credibility because of our songwriting and our hits, and us already having hits with other artists. So it really wasn't a big transition as far as the music went.
Didn't you actually tour with the guys from Oak Ridge, the Oak Ridge Boys?
Oh, yeah. We toured a lot with them. Yeah. And they're just wonderful guys. They really, there's some artists that took us under the wing. They probably them more than anybody. Toured a lot with Lee Greenwood, with the Gatlins, Ricky Skaggs. I think the Oak Ridge Boys, though, really, I think we toured, I guess, maybe for a year or so when we first moved to the country. And they're just wonderful guys, still are, still great friends, and then they're very generous with us. They're just great guys.
Yeah, Joe wrote a great book. We had him on a little while ago about his new book.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Joe's he's a cool guy. He was and all the guys are. So,
So tell us then, after all this stuff's going on, you're having all these hits in the country thing, what happened to the band?
Well, towards the, as with a lot of bands, I mean, you kind of start getting burnt out a little bit. Around the late 80s, I was the first one to leave the band, and then a little bit later, Les left, and then JP left, and then the band went through member changes. Sonny and Steve were there pretty much through the whole thing. So the band went through different incarnations, all of them good, but some of them a little different, I think. Then the original lineup sort of disbanded briefly in the mid, I think it was the early to mid 90s. I wasn't involved, so I don't remember exactly. But then the original, what we refer to as the original five of us, who basically played on all the records and all that, we, in 2008, we got together for what was supposed to be one day. It was supposed to be a benefit for a former tour manager who had been, injured in a motorcycle wreck, and
you're talking about Raymond Patrick.
Raymond Patrick, yeah absolutely. And this was in Lexington, our hometown, and we did a couple of rehearsals, and started planning, and we actually realized, this sounds pretty damn good. And it was really the first time I think we figured in 23 years that the five of us had been on stage together. But it all came back real quick, and 8 years later, we're still doing it. We're playing more dates than ever this year. So it's just one of those odd, lucky connections. We're lucky to all still be around, all still have good health, still be able to play. So we're actually very blessed to still be able to do it.
Now, you have a daughter, right?
I do.
Is she musically inclined?
A little. Well, she never did it as a career. She actually, she played drums for a few years. She wanted to be a drummer. I've got a grandchild, a little boy, Thomas. He's almost two. Interestingly enough, he seems to be pretty musically inclined. He's already got a little piano and stuff and all that sort of stuff. And JP has a daughter who is in the business, a really good singer. So. It does seem to kind of run in the family.
It usually does, and the reason I ask you that, because your parents kind of forced you to take piano lessons and kept you at it, and it ended up being pretty fortuitous for you. Did you encourage or force your daughter to take any instrument lessons?
I did not. I remember maybe buying her a little keyboard at some point, like I had my grandson, but no, I never did really. I'll say I encouraged her if she ever showed any interest or, asked me questions about the business. But no, I never. I don't really think that's a good idea. Even though it worked out for me, I think you should let. She actually just ended up being a paramedic of all things. Which
there you go. That's a good thing. It's interesting.
Really good thing. So, I never really tried to force her into the business. And I think I can speak for JP. I don't think he tried to force his daughter into the business. It's just something she chose to do.
Yeah.
And, we're all very encouraging towards her. But, you either should be a musician or singer or you shouldn't. I mean, you can't force it or you can't force talent. You either have it or you don't.
Right. Yeah. Now, I understand between getting back with the band and leaving the band, you worked for a little bit with Jerry Reed.
I did. After I left the band, I worked with Jerry for a couple of years. Very interesting experience, just being around Jerry and some of the great stories he would tell about, working with Elvis and Chet Atkins and all those people.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry was an interesting character, as you might guess, and of course a brilliant musician. So yeah, it was very cool. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, he I guess he came to my attention with the song "Spiders and Snakes" years ago,
Yeah, he did. You know, he was kind of known, in a sense, for sort of novelty songs. But, I mean, again, Jerry's just one of the great guitar players ever. You know, other guitarists considering that. So it was interesting to work. And at the time, I played guitar a little bit, too. So I think I took the job hoping I would learn more from Jerry. But I can't say as I did. Jerry was just one of those players. He couldn't explain what he did. He just did it.
Yeah,
you know, so,
he did it well.
So. And he did it very well.
Yeah. So let me ask you a question. Do you ever write music? I know that initially you didn't, but have you contributed any writing to Exile or any of the other bands?
No, I don't. I think through the years I discovered I'm not a particularly good songwriter. And I just, I think my contribution through in Exile and other ways in other groups too. It's mainly in production and arrangement and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I just, as I say, I tried songwriting. I think I have maybe one cut on an album, but I just figured out that's not really what I'm good at. So, I just kind of really gave it, you know, sort of concentrate on other things basically.
It's good to recognize that, but there are people I know who are in the music business who are not good songwriters, but they always try to insist that they had one of their songs on every album, so they got some, you know, some royalties.
Yeah, I never wanted to do that, and actually, I don't think that's ever really happened in our. Well, it may have happened in early days of the band, but those guys are no longer in the band, you know. But no, that luckily. That really, after the band solidified in the 70s, that never really happened. Everyone just kind of, you know, just let the great writers work and just do what they write.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now, if folks want to go see Exile, where can they see the tour schedule?
Well, actually, the best place is our website. And their site is exile.biz, B-I-Z. And we keep that pretty updated. We have our initial tour dates on there. We're literally adding dates every day. I just got a call for a couple of days right before I talked to you. So we try to keep that updated at least once a week, maybe sometimes a couple of times a week. So
okay. And if folks I want to follow you, do you have a your own Twitter account and Facebook account or anything?
You know, I don't do Twitter. Frankly, I'm not particularly high-tech on that sort of stuff. However, we do have a really good Facebook page. We have a couple of people who handle that for us. And our Facebook page is called Exile Band Official. There's some other Facebook pages that are, I mean, they're good pages, but they're not our page.
So right.
Exile
okay.
Band Official. And we put stuff on there every day. And, you know, each week we'll making a point to tell where we're going to be. So those are two good ways to keep up with us.
Okay, and what I'll do is after this is put up on the web, I'll send a link to there so that you guys can put up the interview and folks can listen to it.
Oh, great. Yeah, that'd be really good. Yeah, absolutely.
And it's,
anything else you need?
I think we're all set. The only thing I don't have is your official Greatest Hits CD. I was trying to get a hold of that from someone. But
you know something? Believe it or not, we've stopped selling that temporarily, and I think we're going to get some more copies. Let me see. I've got your website, tmpco@aol.com. Is that your site? Or?
That's my email address. Yeah.
I'm at your email address.
Yeah.
I tell you what, we're going to get some more copies just to send out for promo. And it may be a few weeks, but when I get it, I'm going to keep your address. When I get a copy, I'll be glad to send you a copy.
I would appreciate that.
Yeah,
and I look forward to one of these days. If you're ever in Boston or on Cape Cod, call and we'll get together.
Yeah, I'd love to, Mark. I'm going to keep your information, and if we get that area, I'll be sure and get in touch with you then.
It's an actual pleasure talking to you, and enjoy the rest of your day.
All right, thanks, Mark. I appreciate it.
Take care. Bye bye.
See you. Bye.